Well, it's a delight to get to be here with you all 2 weeks in a row. And I want to pick up on last week's talk and expand a little bit. And we talked about the ground and the path and the fruit of practice and how that leads into an exploration of the five spiritual faculties or the five spiritual strengths, which are faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. And I just want to take a minute or two, if for those who were here last week, was there anything lingering from the talk, something that was left with you that you wanted to ask about or bring in? Okay, all right, good. So what I would like to do this evening is continue with this, and I want to talk more about faith, the practice of faith, or sadha, the Pali word, S-A-D-D-H-A, which is the most beautiful translation that I've heard of sadha, is to place the heart upon. And it feels so good to think about placing my heart upon something that feels safe and reliable and there for me, to place my heart upon this path of practice, this way of life, or trust or confidence. So here's a poem from David White called Faith, the great Irish poet. I want to write about faith, the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night, faithful even as it fades from fullness, slowly becoming the last curving and impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it even the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like the new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. Such a beautiful poem, and this is where we start. Every time we begin again, whether it's in meditation or coming back to the practice, you know, I imagine I know it's true for me, maybe it's true for you, that practice can go in cycles. Cycles of meditation, cycles of study, cycles of exploring in Sangha. And this piece of coming back over and over again because something good is happening here and trusting that, such a powerful practice, such a powerful experience to begin again in whatever way that happens. And so we start with this first principle of the Abhidhamma that I offered in the O Nobly Born invocation. The first principle is to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings, and that includes us. And that is a beginning of sadha. I think that seeds the faith. Or when the Buddha taught, and the teaching goes on, you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. The second principle of the Abhidhamma is that compassion is our most basic nature. When we truly understand our interconnection, compassion arises spontaneously. So we start with ourselves, O nobly born. So I think about that a lot. I think about these two principles of that we are inherently good, to see our own inner nobility, not only in ourselves, but one another, and that compassion is our deepest nature. And it brings me to, I was thinking about this today, three books that I read earlier in the year that were explorations in different ways of faith, trust, and confidence. And the first one was called Smile by Sarah Rule. Anybody familiar with this book? Very, very interesting book. She's a playwright, a Buddhist practitioner, and about 10 years ago, after she had her twins, she got Bell's palsy, you know, an inflammation of the seventh cranial nerve, and it causes the face to droop. And oftentimes with Bell's palsy, it resolves itself in a few months. But for her, it didn't. And what she, it took many, many years, and she's raising children not being able to smile. And so it brought up for me, what would it be like to not be able to express joy or sadness or any emotion through the face? What does that do? And how do we rely on, we rely so much on our facial expressions. So what happens if we can't do that? How do we express in other ways? And if you're familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh's, the story about Thich Nhat Hanh and Pema Chodron, sometimes, I'll tell you the story in a second, but sometimes in his instructions, he'll say, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in, breathing out, I smile. What would that be like if you can't literally smile? How do you do that internally? It's an interesting thing to think about. So the story about Thich Nhat Hanh and Pema Chodron was that she was studying with him, and he gave her these instructions, breathing in, know you're breathing in, breathing out, smile. And she said, I don't want to smile. I'm not happy. And he said, I'm not asking you to be happy. I'm asking you to smile. So what if we can't? How do we shift that? And how do we have trust and confidence in a practice that asks us to do something that is not physically accessible? Or maybe it's not emotionally accessible. And how do we find that trust anyway? So it's a very interesting book. It's called Smile. The other one is Jill Bolte Taylor's book, My Stroke of Insight. Anybody familiar with that book? Yeah, fascinating. It's probably 15 years old at this point, maybe more. Jill Bolte Taylor is a brain scientist at Harvard. And when she was 36 or so, she actually had a stroke. And it was the kind of stroke that somehow miraculously she had the presence of mind to watch it happen, to literally be able to be so present with every experience of this stroke occurring that she watched her cognition decline and decline and decline, and it's what happened. But what was so interesting about it is that what she learned in this is that no emotion lasts more than 90 seconds. She started watching the fear, the startle, the everything that came with it. And she started learning through her research that the literal experience of a given emotion doesn't last more than 90 seconds, but the residual of it does. So we may experience anger and feel angry all day long because it has residual. This is very interesting research, and I can't say much more about it except that I was very taken with this book. It was fascinating. And she did lots of study about what's happening in the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. But what really struck me about it that takes us back to this practice of faith is that in her recovery and in all of the training that she needed to do to recover the ability to speak and work and know numbers and colors and everything she had to do, she decided to leave out of her retraining all of the ways she had previously been unkind to herself, because she knew she could train herself towards kindness, towards generosity. And she understood how the brain worked with neurons that fire together, wire together, and the propensity of the mind to strengthen what one pays attention to. So she made a deliberate decision to trust that she could help her recovery by not allowing in the negative, unkind things she used to tell herself about herself. Isn't this interesting? So it takes a certain amount of trust and faith and confidence to do that. And then the third book that I thoroughly enjoyed and spent a lot of time with is Frank Ostoseski's book, The Five Invitations. Anybody read this? So beautiful, beautiful book on death and dying. And he says there are five main chapters in the book, and this is about how do we show up for our lives and for each other to truly be present. Don't wait, he says. Don't wait. Welcome everything and push away nothing. Bring your whole self to the experience. Rest in the middle of things and cultivate don't know mind. All of this takes a certain amount of trust and confidence and faith and beginning again, over and over again. There's a question that he poses in this book. And what he says is, imagine that you yourself become a jigsaw puzzle and that you get a cardboard picture of yourself, a big life-size image of yourself in cardboard. And then one of those laser things that makes jigsaw puzzles cuts you into a jigsaw puzzle, literally. And what he says, when you start putting yourself back together, what do you start with? What parts do you naturally include of yourself? What parts do you leave for later? Or what parts do you leave out entirely? What kind of faith and courage and trust and confidence does it take to include all parts of oneself? This comes back to, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, remember who you are, the goodness of your heart, the luminous nature of the mind. You can trust it, return to it. It is home. This is part of the practice of faith. Here's a piece I want to read to you that's out of Jack Kornfield's book, The Wise Heart, also on this subject of how do we trust who we are. He says, I heard the story of a high school history teacher some years ago. On one particular fidgety and distracted afternoon, she told her class to stop all their academic work. She let her students rest while she wrote on the blackboard a list of names of everyone in the class. And then she asked them to copy the list. She instructed them to use the rest period to write beside each name one thing they liked or admired about the student. And at the end of the class, she collected all of the papers. And weeks later, on another difficult day just before winter break, the teacher again stopped the class. She handed each student a sheet with his or her name on top, and on it she had pasted all 26 good things the other students had written about that person. They smiled and gasped in pleasure that so many beautiful qualities were noticed about them. And 3 years later, this teacher received a call from the mother of one of her former students. Robert had been a cut-up, but also one of her favorites. His mother sadly passed on the terrible news that Robert had been killed in the Gulf War. The teacher attended the funeral where many of Robert's former friends and high school classmates spoke. And just as the service was ending, Robert's mother approached her. She took out a worn piece of paper, obviously folded and refolded many times, and said, this was one of the few things in Robert's pocket when the military retrieved his body. It was the paper on which the teacher had so carefully pasted the 26 things his classmates had admired. Seeing this, Robert's teacher's eyes filled with tears. As she dried her wet cheeks, another former student standing nearby opened her purse, pulled out her own carefully folded page, and confessed that she always kept it with her. A third ex-student said that his page was framed and hanging in his kitchen. Another told how the page had become part of her wedding vows. The perception of goodness invited by this teacher had transformed the hearts of her students in ways she might only have dreamt about. We can each remember a moment when someone saw this goodness in us and blessed us. On retreat, a middle-aged woman remembers the one person, a nun, who was kind to her when, as a frightened and lonely teenager, and she gave birth out of wedlock. She carried her name all these years. A young man I worked with in juvenile hall, Jack says, remembers the old gardener next door who loved and valued him. The gardener's respect stuck with him through all his troubles. And Nelson Mandela says, "It never hurts to think too highly of a person. They often become ennobled and act better because of it." So what is that like when somebody else has confidence and trust and faith in us? It says, oh, I'm worth it. I can do this in myself. So from the perspective of the Dharma, there are four kinds of faith, and they build on each other, and they may sound linear, but like so many lists, they are interwoven and become more of a figure eight or a spiral. So the first of these forms of faith is called bright faith. That's what we often feel when we first come into practice and get that sense of, oh, this is home. I belong here. I'm going to do this. This is what I want. That sense of maybe falling in love, or a sense of infatuation, all in, single-mindedness, knowing this is really it. Did anybody feel that way? I felt that way. When I first came to practice, I felt like, ah, this is where I can be. And I still feel that way. I do. And that it's exciting, you know, it's very uplifting. And there's something that happens in that quality. It gives us this energy, this momentum to keep going. And as the Zen teacher Rafe Martin says, he says, maybe we step out again after that sitting a little lighter, a little steadier, a little happier, a little less heavily there, a bit more present here. And so a bit more capable of just a little more spontaneous kindness and generosity. So something starts happening in us. And then time goes on, and you know how infatuation starts to diminish. Like something happens, you have your first argument, or something doesn't go so well in practice, and you start to doubt it. There's a little bit of, I'm not so sure about this. Maybe I don't need to do this. And doubts arise. It's completely natural. And I think that in my experience of practice and the hindrance of doubt and also the juice of doubt is that there are two primary kinds of doubt. The kind of doubt that can keep one stuck. I don't know if I'm going to sit. It's not quiet enough. I forgot my candle. It's really cold in here. It's too loud. It's too this. It's too that. You know, that kind of maybe just doubting Thomas that we sort of lose our oomph. But then there's the kind of doubt that is really functional, the kind that says, what is going on here? What is getting in my way? The kind that helps us inquire about it. And I think that kind of doubt is very interesting. You know, to actually be able to say, huh, maybe I'm afraid of something. Maybe I'm not going to get it quite right, but I'm going to do it anyway. So there is a way in which doubt can be very, very functional. And one of the ways to work with doubt is to come back to Sangha, right? We come back, we begin again. Maybe coming back to the refuges, reminding yourself, myself, sometimes, you know, chanting refuges, there's something so reassuring about that. Beginning again, but also allowing myself to have doubt. And this is called the borrowed faith. When the bright faith falters, we need to borrow some. Borrow confidence, borrow trust. Can I come with you? I want to sit with you in your Sangha. Maybe it'll remind me. So this is the borrowed faith that happens. And then this third kind of faith is called verified faith. And this is where we find our footing again. It's when we start feeling some of the benefits of practice, that something good is happening. And we can be reminded of the teaching of the Buddha, the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha said, don't believe me, find out for yourself. What is it that supports your well-being? What is it that leads to non-greed, non-ill will, ill will and clarity of mind? And do that. What is it when you do it that leads to states of greed and ill will and delusion? And stop doing that. And we start, if you start noticing, and I know I've noticed, how is practice actually showing up in my life? What are the fruits of it? It starts to build the momentum and support my confidence and support my trust. This becomes the verified faith. So a couple ways of looking at this. In the short run, Abe Lincoln is known for having said, "When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion." Right? It's just so commonsensical. That's the other part of what I love about this practice. It feels so logical. And then the Buddha also says to cultivate a certain amount of verified faith, you can ask a long run question. And this long run question is, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness, but not only my own, but the welfare and happiness of others. So this takes the long view. You know, what Abe Lincoln said, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. Those are sort of the immediate response to cause and effect. But the Buddha is saying, take a longer view. Take a longer view. And in that longer view, we can cultivate this more verified confidence. And that's actually a compass question. I call them compass questions, things that keep me on track. What, when I do it, is going to support my well-being, both now and later? And what, when I do it, isn't so good for me? And can I break that habit? So this is all part of how I think this faculty of faith works in the immediate. That like it's a real thing. It's not just conceptual. It's what actually happens. So we start to trust that a little bit. And then the fourth aspect is abiding faith. And this is grown from wisdom and some equanimity. It becomes a continual source in our practice. This ability to say, yep, things are rough. I can do this. I can come back. I'm going to begin again. We trust the practice because we know. We know it supports us. The wisdom from practice is there and it's inside of us. So I want to read you a short piece from Brian Doyle. Anybody familiar with the writer, Brian Doyle? This is truly an amazing collection of essays. This is called One Long River of Song, but he died a few years ago, and he was just an absolutely brilliant writer. I can't recommend him highly enough. And here's the story. This is how I chose this, because I think it exemplifies this verified and abiding confidence. Recently, a man took up residence on my town's football field, sleeping in a small tent in the northwestern corner near the copse of cedars. He'd been a terrific football player some years ago for our high school, and then had played in college and then a couple of years in the nether reaches of the professional ranks, where a man might get paid $100 a game plus bonuses for touchdowns and sacks. And then he'd entered into several business ventures, but these hadn't gone so well. And he had married and had children, but that hadn't gone so well either. And finally, he'd taken up residence on the football field because, he said, that's where things had gone well. And he sort of needed to get balanced again. And there was something about the field that was working for him, as far as he could tell. So with all due respect to people who thought he was a nutcase, he decided he would stay there until someone made him leave. He'd already spoken with the cops, and it was a mark of the general decency of our town that he was told he could stay as long as he didn't interfere with the use of the field, which, of course, he never would think of doing. And it was summer anyway, so the field wasn't in use much. He'd been nicknamed the Hawk when he was a player for his habit of lurking around almost lazily on defense and then making a stunning strike, and he still speaks of the way he played, quietly, but then amazingly. When we sat on the visiting team's bench the other day, he said some quietly amazing things, which I think you should hear. The reporter from the paper came by, he said, She wanted to write a story about the failure of the American dream and the collapse of the social contract, and she was just melting to use football as a metaphor for something or other. And I know she was just trying to do her job, but I kept telling her things that didn't fit what she wanted, like that people come by and leave me cookies and sandwiches, and the kids who play lacrosse at night set up a screen so my tent won't get peppered with stray shots, and the cops drift by at night to make sure no one's giving me grief. Everyone gets nailed at some point, so we understand someone getting nailed and trying to get back up on his feet again. I'm not a drunk, and there's no politicians to blame. I just lost my balance. People are good to me. You try to get lined up again. I keep the field clean. Mostly it's discarded water bottles, lost cell phones I hang in a plastic bag by the gate. I walk the perimeter a lot. I saw some coyote pups the other day. I don't have anything smart to say. I don't know what things mean. Things just are what they are. I never sat on the visitor's bench before, did you? Someone leaves coffee for me every morning by the gate. The other day, a lady came by with twin infants, and she let me hold one while we talked about football. The baby weighed about half of nothing. You couldn't believe a human being could be so tiny, and there were two of them. That reporter, she kept asking me what I had learned and what I would say to her readers if there was only one thing I could say, and I told her, what could possibly be better than standing on a football field holding a brand new human being the size of a coffee cup? You know what I mean? Everything else is sort of a footnote. So I think that is what faith is, confidence and trust. That we come back over and over again and sense our own goodness, recognize our own vulnerabilities. We're not going to always get it right. Sometimes we doubt it completely. We need to come back to a source that supports us, each other. Sometimes the teachings, sometimes whatever we've learned in practice, our own wisdom. Know that we have a right to be here, that this practice can hold us. When I say we have a right to be here, the image that just flashed in my mind as I was talking about this is, oftentimes in the image of a Buddha, you can see the sculpture itself. The Buddha has a mudra, a hand up, and one, the right hand touching the earth. And that image of, I belong, I have a right to be here. This is the expression, I think, of this faculty of faith, of sadha, this discovering of our inner nobility, not only our own, but each other's, that gives us the capacity to begin again, over and over and over again, no matter how many times. This is our practice, to place the heart upon, to commit to practice, to trust it, to know that the wisdom that we gain, that develops, is real. And it itself is trustworthy. Norman Fisher says this: may I walk up the stairs to rise up in goodness with everyone, walk down the stairs to deepen my commitment to truth for the benefit of others, leave the house to go forth to do some good for someone else, and return home in the hope that all beings will one day return to their true home. Thank you for listening. We have plenty of time to talk with each other. So any kind of, I could go on and on and on, but I really wanted to end it there and just open it up so we can talk with each other.
I'll just say that that was totally lovely.
I loved
hearing again the story from Jack Kornfield. I had heard that over the years, but I haven't heard it for a long time. And it's everything you shared with us was just a blessing.
Oh,
thank you very much. That was beautiful.
You're so welcome.
Thank you.
You know, that story from Jack, every time I read it, I think, I need to do this. I mean, I need to do it in a group of whatever. It could be Sangha. It could be a gathering of friends coming over. What if we just did it and just wrote it down and had that? What a gift that would be.
I was actually thinking that it would be a nice thing to do with a group of my friends, or something that we could do in Sangha. I was actually thinking that when you were reading it, and that gift that she gave to her students was just, well, powerful. And
so powerful.
They took it with them into their lives.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Deborah.
And also the quote from Abe Lincoln, I don't think I'd ever heard that.
I don't know where I got it, but it's been in my notes for years. And it just makes so much sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I want to read all three of the books. I was just telling a Sangha friend, I think yesterday, that I kind of have stopped reading books. Mm-hmm. But now that you've mentioned those three books, I want to read all of them.
I think it's one of the problems of our digital lives. And I don't know if anybody else notices it, but there's so much, I would say, delight and refuge, actually, in picking up a book and not having any device around me, making a cup of tea, and actually reading a book. It's so basic, and it's such a delight. So I'm glad you said that, Deborah.
Well, recently I took, this is from the 90s, I think, Random Acts of Kindness. It's a really old book, and yeah, it's a small book. And I take it to bed with me now at night.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, because they're really short and they're just heart melting. They're
so good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who else?
What was the name of that first poem about the...
Oh, sure. This first poem is from Rosemary Wattola Traumer. It's called Beside the Lake, A Note to Self. It's Beside the Lake, comma, A Note to Self.
Thank you.
And you can...
to get it.
Yeah, you can look up Rosemary, wordwoman.com.
Thank you.
That's how you can find her. You're welcome. Kylie, please. Oops, where'd you go?
Thanks, Heidi. Yeah. That was lovely. I hope you didn't say this already, but that song, that story, Jack Kornfield's story, which I've heard before too, that I adore, always reminds me of that beautiful quote about to love somebody is to learn the song that's in their heart and then sing it to them when they've forgotten.
Isn't that gorgeous? That just gave me chills.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
How do we remind each other of our goodness, you know, when we lose the ability to see it ourselves?
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I find it easier to see it in others than I do in myself.
Totally.
And I guess that's the point of that quote. If we all learn each other's song and be a mirror of that goodness to one another, when we forget ourselves.
That is it. It's what we're doing. And I think this is the refuge in Sangha. Because we may not know each other, but there's a way in which we don't have to. Mm. And yes, in intimate relationships and friendships, yes, of course, when we reflect back to each other what we know of this person. But just the acknowledgement of you belong, I belong, we are here together with some inherent like-mindedness. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And so one of the things we can do right now, just as a way to do it, and for those who aren't on video, if you feel like turning your video on, if you have the bandwidth for it, we can just look at each other. You know, nobody knows who's looking at whom at any moment. And I often do this when we greet each other when I teach for Spirit Rock, where I will be this coming Wednesday, because there are about this many people or more. And what we do is just, like, you know, just say hello by looking at each other. And it's a way of saying, I see you, or I know somebody sees me. We don't have to say anything, but we say, oh yeah, you're here too. I am too. It's actually one of the cool things about Zoom. It's like you really can look at each other and nobody knows.
So speaking of that, Heidi, are you going to be at Spirit Rock Live or Zoom?
Zoom on Wednesday morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Is Spirit Rock ever going to open back up for Wednesday and Thursday morning classes, or is it going to be pretty much Zoom?
As far as I know, I think it's going to be Zoom because so many people are coming from all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah. Kylie's saying, yes, yes, me. So
I wish we could do both. We could have when we have something here, we do live but
it's true.
Anyway, I miss the in-person.
Oh yeah, totally. Totally. I know it. So if you want to I'll just jump in here real quickly. If you want to know what I'm up to, you can always check my website, pacificmindfulness.com, and you can find out all the stuff that I'm doing. Who else on this topic from tonight? Let's talk about practice tonight and faith. Anything else from the talk? Barbara.
Hi, could you read the quote that you closed the class with?
From Norman?
Yeah, I think it was the last quote you read.
Yes, you bet. This is Norman Fisher. And don't ask me which one of his books it came out of, because I don't remember. May I walk up the stairs to rise up in goodness with everyone. Walk down the stairs to deepen my commitment to truth for the benefit of others. Leave the house to go forth to do some good for someone else, and return home in the hope that all beings will one day return to their true home. It's beautiful, isn't it? You'll be able to get it off of the recording. What else? Alice, please.
Hi, since we're asking for you to repeat things, could you repeat the Lincoln quote?
When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That is my religion.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm pretty sure he says that is my religion at the end of it. Yeah. Yeah. Who else? Deborah, sure.
Well, this is unfair, but anybody can cut me off. I was wondering if you would repeat the titles of the books, those three books.
Yes, I'm happy to. The titles of the book, Smile.
Oh, right.
By Sarah Ruhl, Ruhl. My Stroke of Insight.
Oh, right.
Jill Bolte Taylor. 5 Invitations, Frank Ostasevsky.
Oh, yes.
And truly, everybody, this book knocked my socks off. One Long River of Song by Brian Doyle. And, you know, Deborah's comment about, I take the book to bed with me because they're just short little pieces. These are short essays. It's that kind of book that you can just sit down and read a couple of pages. And I mean, I could go on and on and on and read you from Brian Doyle because it's so beautiful. And I learned so much. I'd like to find something in here. Does anybody else have another question? So, okay, my question to you. How does this aspect of practice work for you? What do you notice with the practice of faith or confidence or trust? Anybody willing to talk about that? Mary, please. Yeah.
So it is a way it offers comfort to disappointment.
That's beautiful. It offers comfort to disappointment. Yeah,
it offers space to just stop, and it'll remind myself that there's another moment coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I've said something, I've done something or whatever, usually it's disappointment in myself. Mm-hmm. That this isn't permanent.
It totally isn't.
You know, and so that it's like you can just, okay, well, honey, you know, that wasn't what you wanted to be doing. But so now you have an opportunity to, you know, change directions, practice the open heart that you want to have. And I really like what you had said, talked about, and I guess the quote we had read. The Paramis by Ajahn Suchito, and just the whole idea of patience, and that it's, you know, making that space with time. And to me, that kind of ties together with that.
Yeah,
is that having patience with myself is kind of an act of faith as well.
Completely. It is. And I loved what you just said. Oh, honey, you know, using the honey voice is truly important.
That's great.
That's not a small thing.
Nope.
That is not a small thing to talk to, you know, to relate to oneself with that kind of honey, sweetheart voice, that softness, that endearment. Because it just says, yeah, we can do this again. Okay, course correct, course correct.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the beautiful gifts of the Dharma, at least for me it is.
I agree.
Is that I can take this refuge with me. It's portable. It goes wherever I go.
Isn't nice. That the best? I totally agree with you. Thank you, Mary.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Liz, and then we'll do our metta.
Hi. My faith in the Dharma comes from my teachers. I have faith in my teachers from whom I learned the Dharma, mostly on retreat. Mm-hmm. And it's not faith in the Dharma just by reading scripture or you know. Basically, I have faith in the teachers, and that leads me to faith in the Dharma.
And does that lead you to faith in yourself?
Sometimes. Uh-huh. I think their faith in me.
Exactly.
My teacher's faith in me leads me to faith in myself.
And that is what the Buddha gave us when he said, don't believe me, find out for yourself, because I think you're going to find out that this works, because I trust you.
Well, I love A.E. Pasico, find out for yourself.
A.E. Pasico, that's exactly right.
Being a New Yorker, that's very important to me. I need to find out for myself. But my teacher's love for me and my love for them establishes the faith and the Dharma. I was talking to Sharon about this a while back. Sharon and Joseph and Jack, their teachers loved them. This was a love affair.
Yeah.
This is their love affair with the entrance into the Dharma and their teachers' faith in them.
That's right.
I think teachers are extraordinarily important. They have been for me.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for saying that. Yeah.